Welcome to Stateside and happy Monday. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the first time in 2 weeks, teachers are back in the business of teaching and students back in the business of learning in the Buena Vista School District in Saginaw. That's after the district had to close school doors because it couldn't meet payroll. On today's show, just how bad are finances for school districts across Michigan? Could your district be next? But first, Sunday mornings to so many of us means a full pot of coffee and our Sunday paper. And there has certainly been no shortage of dire and ominous headlines with that Sunday morning coffee, has there? Well, that's why the Detroit Free Press has launched a new movement, if you will. It's called A Better Michigan, and it will seek the answers to that question, what will it take to build a better Michigan? We here at Michigan Radio and on Stateside are very proud to be partnering in this effort with the Detroit Free Press. Joining me is the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, Stephen Henderson. Very good to have you on the program.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
So, A Better Michigan, what's really behind this new thrust in the Free Press and with all of us who will be your media partners?
Well, you know, the name we came up with sort of by trying to sort of refine, I guess, the mission of the Free Press editorial page, and we kept trying to sort of boil all the different things we do and all the different issues we advocate for down to a very simple phrase, and the one we kept coming back to was the idea that anything we write, anything we say, anything we publish really is about trying to move the state forward, move the state, move the city, move Southeast Michigan forward, whether it's education, whether it's transit, whether it's politics. They all sort of have their roots in that idea. And so we thought, well, instead of that being sort of an understood idea, why not make it sort of the explicit way we refer to ourselves and refer to the work that we do. So that's where we came out. There were several other ideas on the table. Some of them I thought were a little more clever. but really, A Better Michigan, I think, really captures exactly what we're about.
Stephen, I'm wondering why now. Was there a tipping point for you personally in terms of the grim stories and the grim headlines about the Detroit area and about Michigan that made you say, you know what, let's do this?
You know, that was a big part of what we were doing, yes. I mean, I think in the last, let's say, I don't know, 2 years at least in Detroit, I have felt, as the editorial page editor here, as though everything that happens has so much more weight and so much more importance than it did before. And there's so much more going on. I mean, Detroit is in a very precarious position right now and at a very pivotal point in that precarious position. The state, having gone through not just one recession, but, you know, an entire decade of decline before that recession, is also in a very unusual position, something that we're not used to. You know, the idea of trying to sort of improve and get back to where we were is much more prominent now than it would have been a year or 5 years ago. And so that was a lot of the impetus for rethinking at least the name. You know, we're also in a business that's changing pretty rapidly, too, the newspaper business.
Sure.
And so a lot of what we were doing in terms of designing the site and the newspaper section was thinking about, okay, what are the things that we can do now because of technology and competition that weren't possible before?
And that leads to the fact you have a lot of media partners, including Mission Radio and Stateside and State of Opportunity, going into this effort. What does it mean to you as the Free Press editorial page editor to have all these media partners?
Well, I mean, we chose the partners on the basis of how they fit in with that mission, right? I think one of the things that we haven't been really good at in the newspaper business is recognizing that there are lots of other people who are fighting just as hard as we are and advocating for the very similar things to the things that we're pushing for. And so with A Better Michigan, we wanted to again, make that even more explicit. Here are the people who share our values. Here are the people who are producing the same kind of content that we aspire to, whether it's news, whether it's editorial, whether it's colonizing, whether it's a print or radio or television. There are lots of institutions now that are also saying, how do we make things better? And so we wanted to link arms with you guys publicly and say, all of this stuff should be in one place. You should be able to look at all of these things together and see how the sort of common themes come through.
I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press editorial page editor Stephen Henderson about the new effort called A Better Michigan, and Michigan Radio is very pleased to be a partner in this effort. I would love your thoughts, Stephen. Do you think there is something in particular that the media can do in coming together and focusing on A Better Michigan that, let's say, a politician or a business couldn't do?
Well, I mean, I think I've always thought as editorial page editor at the paper, one of the things I even say, I vocalize this quite a bit, is I don't have to stand for re-election, right? You know, I'm sort of in this job, and the Free Press has been here for 181 years. It's not going anywhere, and so that in and of itself gives a freedom to sort of take unpopular stands and to push for things that. That maybe not everybody would be about. One of the other sort of corollaries to that I've always believed is that the editorial page in particular helps give voice to people who are voiceless in debates. And so that becomes something that's a lot easier as a news organization than if I had to go out and raise money or ask people for their votes. I mean, I suppose in one way we face an election every morning when people go to the newsstand or don't, or go to their browsers and either click on us or don't. But I certainly feel more freedom than I think I would if I were part of the political process. And I think there are more people now feeling that way. One of the other partners in this effort is the Center for Michigan, which is another sort of independent think and do tank, started by a former newspaper publisher who I think saw the opportunity to, again, push for good ideas, whether they come from the left or the right, and not feel like you're pressured to pander to either side for votes or for money.
And as you think about launching A Better Michigan and bringing on all of us as partners, Stephen, what are you hoping ultimately to accomplish with this?
Well, I mean, again, the idea is to change the state and get the state back on track. We still have enormous problems in the state. As much progress as I feel like we've made bouncing back from sort of the bottom, there is a lot of work to do when you look at our schools, when you look at our roads, drive our roads. I drove to Grand Rapids this weekend and back to Detroit, and you know, you can't do that without noticing how much work there is to do. I think the idea of A Better Michigan is leveraging not just the power of the Free Press, but lots of different institutions to try to first shine light on the problems that exist, and then to sort of frame them in the context of what are the solutions to these things? What are the things we can do as a state to move forward?
And I have to imagine that underpinning all of this is the desire that so many of us have to make us feel like we're more on the same team and,
yes,
and think about the greater good of Michigan.
That's right. And to see that even when we disagree about how to do something or in what time frame to do something, there are so many people on the left and the right who want the same things. Ultimately, we want good schools for our kids. We want good roads. We want a better mass transit system. And I think highlighting where those sort of competing ways of getting into those things intersect is an important part of our new site.
Stephen, what would you say to people who say, you know, I don't think this is the role of the media. The role of the media is to just report the stories, not take positions, if you will, but just report the facts. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I mean, I think they're not wrong in that it is our part of our role is to just report the facts and tell the stories. But newspapers have always had, you know, editorial pages and columnists who express opinion. Sometimes their own opinions, sometimes opinions on behalf of the institution. But we also have keen senses of public service that go beyond our regular news reporting. And there's nothing new about that. I mean, the idea of public service journalism is very rich, and it has a very rich history, not just with the Free Press in Detroit, but with lots of other media outlets, some of whom, you know, including Michigan Radio, who we've linked arms with in this endeavor. That is part of the role of media as well. And it's important to keep those things separate and not sort of let them bleed into each other. But it's just as important to make sure that this side of what we do doesn't suffer for the effort to produce the other.
Well, we here at Michigan Radio and on Stateside are very glad to be part of what's seen as a constructive, positive effort to make Michigan a better place. And we are very much looking forward to working with you and your Free Press team.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to working with you guys, too.
I've been speaking with the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, Stephen Henderson, and I bet you this isn't the last time we're going to be talking.
Hopefully not.
Thank you, Stephen.
Absolutely. Thank you, too.
In the Buena Vista School District, teachers are back in the business of teaching, and students are back in the business of learning for the first time in 2 weeks. It's been a very uncertain 2 weeks since the Buena Vista School Board laid off all but 3 staff members and closed down the schools because there just wasn't enough money to keep things running. It took a new deficit elimination plan and the state releasing 3 months of state aid that had been withheld to recoup funding for a program for incarcerated youth. The district had stopped running the program but had not notified Lansing. It is convoluted. It is confusing. But in all of these news stories and all of these headlines, there is one crystal clear reality. Students are suffering, and so are their teachers who actually offered to work without pay. One of those teachers joins us now. He actually coaches high school men's basketball. Tori Jackson joins us now from Saginaw. Hi, Tori.
Hello. How are you?
Good. I have to ask you, how does it feel to be back with the students after these 2 weeks?
It's great. It's a great feeling. Love the kids, obviously. I do it just for them. I appreciate, you know, the way they came in today and just kind of got back to the normal schedule, to be honest. It just seems like no one's missing a beat. They've been away for 10 days, you know, 10 school days, so it's a little different, but they enjoy it. They're happy to be back themselves.
What impact do you think, Tori, all of this uncertainty has had on the students?
It just makes some of the kids wonder, should they stay and will school be open next year? Some of them, they wonder if they should even finish the school year out this year. But they're here now, and when they talk to teachers, they get a little clearer understanding and they feel a little bit better and a little more comfortable. So I think they should be fine.
As someone who was in the middle of all of this as a teacher and also as a former student, because I know you went there to school, what has been the overall feeling and the mood among the teachers and students and parents in the Buena Vista District while all of this has been going on?
At one point, everybody was pointing fingers, but it got so old that trying to put the blame on somebody, it was just, well, let's get these kids in school. Education is most important, and I think these kids missed out on a lot of it. This is the most important part, actually, of the school year, that last month and a half, 2 months, where kids trying to push to get those grades, those final grades in so they can graduate or get to the next grade level. And we were in the midst of it and everything shut down. So it was a sad point because you really don't want to point fingers. But I think at the end of the day, everybody just wanted, it made everybody come together and just find some kind of solution. And we got it done.
I'm speaking with the high school men's basketball coach for Buena Vista High School. Do you want to grab that?
Oh, no, that was just a bell.
Oh, that was a bell. All right. Yeah. Getting people into class.
Yeah.
Tori Jackson is the high school men's basketball coach at Buena Vista High School. And you actually went to Buena Vista High before going to Notre Dame and playing for the Irish. And you actually played for a year in the NBA Development League.
Yep.
What brought you back to Buena Vista?
The kids. and that's why I was so sad. I care about the kids. I care about my community. Everybody asks the same question. Why do you come back? Why do you turn down so much money to come back and deal with this, you know, uncertainty? But I do it for the kids. I honestly feel like there's a lot of potential in Saginaw, and I hate seeing so many youth killing each other or reverting to the streets because nobody's actually taking the time with them. Nobody cares. I want to show them that somebody cares and somebody actually wants to see them become successful.
You know, there's been so much reporting, Tori, about Buena Vista and its financial troubles, and people who've never heard of the district now know it is the one that had to shut down before the end of the school year. You know, doors are open again now for to be able to see the year out. But I'm wondering, as someone who went there and someone who teaches there, can you tell us what do we not know and not understand about your school district?
It's not even – I don't try to get into too much into it, but – I know we're in a better position than most other schools are. And we're not the only school that's going through a financial crisis. I feel like we're in a better position now than we were 2-3 weeks ago. We got the help. Now we just got to put certain plans together, and we can be running and even stronger. We can be a stronger school than we were the last 2 years. You know, I think ultimately the kids will win out. The education is most important. And I feel like everything should be fine within a year or two. BV should be running perfectly again.
Buena Vista High School men's basketball coach Tori Jackson. Tori, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, there are those who say the Buena Vista district is the proverbial canary in the coal mine, and more struggling districts may soon be swamped by red ink. Case in point, Albion Schools announced last week they are not going to open their high school next school year. They don't have the money. Last week on Stateside, we heard from Tom Watkins. He served as a state superintendent of schools from 2001 till 2005. He told us that of Michigan's 550 school districts, nearly 50 have been operating at a deficit. And he believes it doesn't make sense to have so many districts, many of them small. And consolidating these small, struggling districts is one way to keep the children in the classrooms. Well, let's take a look at where things really stand in terms of finances for Michigan schools. And is the idea of consolidation a viable solution? Joining me is Michelle Richard. She's a senior consultant at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
And also with us is Michigan State University economist Eric Scorsone. Good to have you back, Eric.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to start with you, Eric. Exactly from what you know, how many districts are really teetering on the brink of financial trouble in Michigan?
Right. Well, you talked about the 50 districts that have a deficit, and that's clearly troubling. I mean, that's about 10% of the Michigan school districts. I think that may be understating some of the pressure that's really out there, though. And I think also we know from a Moody's report that you know, probably 10 or 11 districts are in, you know, severe crisis potentially. And so I think we've been expecting there would be problems. I know there's been a lot of discussion, and I think that, you know, now we're finally seeing with Buena Vista and others that that's really coming to fruition, and I think we may see more of that potentially.
Is there anything that these districts have in common?
I think generally they're smaller districts, which is, you know, I think it's a combination of pressures of mandated expenditures that have to occur along with sort of a stagnant revenue from the state and local sources, and really the cost of benefits and other health care costs that continue to rise. So I think the districts are being squeezed, and smaller districts have fewer resources, and so they're going to be likely on the front lines. Of course, not all of them are small. You know, Pontiac or even Detroit are obviously much larger districts that have had trouble for a long time.
One other thread to consider is declining enrollment. Buena Vista, for example, in 2009-10 had over 1,000 students, and most recently they had just over 400. You can only cut so quickly. You can only share services so quickly. And when we fund our schools on a per-student basis, if you don't have kids in seats, then you're forced to make some really challenging decisions.
And I'd like your view, Michelle Richard. How did things get to this point? How far back do these financial troubles go?
Well, I think that we've always had districts who have struggled, but we're starting to see more districts who are struggling. And quite honestly, as we look statewide, there are fewer kids in Michigan. So districts are losing enrollment to simply having fewer children in their community. Some of them are struggling with charter schools, but not all of them. And again, when we fund schools on a per student basis, when enrollment declines, funding declines. And we haven't, as a state, figured out a way to bridge that decline for schools so that they can continue to provide a high-quality education for kids and operate in a responsible financial way. Those things have become at odds in many communities, and I think it's something that, as a state, we need to have a more robust discussion about.
It's certainly with the headlines with Buena Vista that has, I think, opened a lot of eyes. Has this decline, is it, can you lay it at the feet of the Great Recession, or is it just a birth rate? What's behind the decline?
Well, I mean, Michelle's absolutely right. Declining enrollment is clearly a critical factor here. And that may certainly not be related to the Great Recession. You know, I think certain districts, certain regions have had, you know, significant population decline. Detroit had a massive population decline in the last decade,
sure.
Really unprecedented. So I think some of it is recessionary, certainly cyclical, if we would call it that. But some of it is more structural. Some of it's been going on for quite a while. And it's just kind of the combination of those things coming together at this point in time that has led to some of the problems we're seeing.
And Eric, how does Michigan compare with other states in terms of the number of districts and how many are in financial trouble?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I haven't really looked at that specifically. I think there are, you know, certainly there's been some national discussion about some of the challenges facing local governments generally, including school districts. But, you know, it's hard to say right now. I think other states are seeing some of this kind of pressure as well.
I want you both to help us look at this idea of consolidation. And the question is, why do we need 550 school districts in Michigan? Michelle?
Yeah, so when I looked at the history of Michigan schools, I think it's really interesting. So in the 20s, we had 7,000 districts in Michigan. Before Michigan was even a state, we had laws requiring communities to form schools if there were over 50 people. And that deep history of local control and of community schools really continues to show up today. I mean, we've had several waves of consolidation, and yet we still have cities that have three or four school districts serving the same community of children. You're going to have a whole lot of different opinions about whether or not consolidation makes sense. I tend to think that if you can demonstrate that there's an educational benefit to kids by being able to provide a more robust curriculum or more specialty educators, and you can at the same time demonstrate that there is a financial benefit, which is not always the case, then it certainly makes a tremendous amount of sense to talk about consolidation. Does it make sense to force it? I don't think that that's, I personally don't think so, but researchers fall on both sides of that equation.
Yeah, I would just add, I think Michelle's right. It depends on what you're looking at. So I think financial benefits, the research tends to show there's benefits more from consolidating smaller districts, and that as you get larger, it's kind of there's not benefits on an infinite level. I mean, essentially, as districts get larger and larger, there's actually probably increasing costs. But that's a generalization. Each situation is very unique. And I think mandating it is problematic because there may be small districts that can operate very effectively. Now, on the educational side, it's trickier, and it's not entirely clear the impact of consolidation. But I think we have to be careful. There's no easy or clear answers, unfortunately, in this area. I mean, it may make sense in some cases. In other cases, it won't. And probably each situation has to be analyzed kind of on its own terms.
Well, we've seen the Department of Education provide some funding for districts to explore that opportunity. I mean, Willow Run and Ypsilanti is one example. They are moving towards and have approved consolidation in that community. And they had some support or will continue to have some support from the Department of Ed because consolidation doesn't happen overnight. I mean, as a state, we require that both districts that are consolidating, that those communities approve consolidation with a vote, and selling that idea within a school community and within the broader community can be really challenging. I mean, for very reasonable things like collective bargaining agreements that are dramatically different, to really personal things, like there's a mascot that has a tremendous amount of history in a local community. So there's a lot of challenges when you start walking down that road.
And what, let's say two districts agree to consolidate and go ahead with it. What does it look like at ground level if you're a student and a parent? Let's start with that.
Well, obviously it may mean shifts in everything from school location to, you know, changes in busing and transportation. So it may affect, you know, a student and a parent's lives in very direct ways, and it may not. Again, it depends on the specifics. Obviously, if, you know, for example, Albion closing a high school where people are kind of used to going and they have that tie to that location, those facilities, you know, that's going to be a big change to someone. Now, they may get a better education over time, but, you know, people, it's not always just about education, obviously, with schools. There's a lot of other, you know, factors that go into that, how people look at it. And so it does have an impact. It have an impact on staff, on teachers, you know, in terms of who's going to be there, who isn't, how the structure of the organization. So it's certainly an impact, and it can't be discounted. I mean, you have to continue to maintain teacher and staff morale and other things. So there are a lot of factors to consider.
Yeah. There's also certainly a curriculum factor. I mean, as a state, we have common standards, grade level content expectations that all schools teach. But the way that they implement those and some of the sequence varies by school to school. So you see that within a school district, too, when you have a lot of middle schools converge into one high school, you need to make sure there's consistency. But when you're merging two separate districts, there'll have to be a lot of planning to make sure that every child is arriving in their classroom with the background knowledge and the supports that they need to be successful, so that you can make sure that every student learned fractions at some point and they didn't just miss that when the schools merged. And that came in fourth grade in one school district, and it came in fifth grade in the other one. There are certainly that curriculum aspect to this as well.
Lots and lots of movable parts and trying to make that happen if consolidation is the road that's chosen. I'm speaking with Michelle Richard, who's a senior consultant at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing, and with Michigan State University economist Eric Scorsone, looking at the pros and cons of consolidation as a possible option for struggling school districts in Michigan, with some 10% of Michigan's 550 districts believed to be in financial trouble, and that may actually be on the low side of things. Eric, what other options do you see for districts that are financially struggling that would not entail consolidation? What else could be done? Because you can only cut to the bone so far, and then there's nothing left to cut.
Right. I mean, obviously, they're going to look at, some districts are looking at, you know, do we provide busing or how do we provide busing? Because it's not a mandated service. They're going to look at athletics and all kinds of other things they provide. You know, do we charge higher fees for things? Do we continue to provide certain non-mandated curriculum items? I mean, and those things have all been done, you know, certainly to some extent, and they're going to be continued to be looked at. You know, you're often going to look at that internal management stuff first, because consolidation is a difficult task. You may also see back office operation consolidation or privatization, everything from maintenance of buildings to payroll. And I think you're going to see more examination, not just school district consolidation, but cities and schools working together more, creating authorities and looking at how do we provide services jointly. And there's even discussion here in Lansing of that kind of process. So, you know, I think all those kind of things are going to be looked at, because consolidation is tough. In Michigan, we have a long history of home rule and sort of liking our local jurisdictions, whether it's a city or a school. And so I think a lot of other options will be explored as well.
That's Eric Scorsone, economist at Michigan State University. We're also speaking with Michelle Richard with Public Sector Consultants. Continuing our discussion about school finances, a topic making headlines all across the state. First, with the Buena Vista District closing its doors 2 weeks ago to students, only reopening today after submitting a deficit elimination plan to the state. Meanwhile, the Pontiac School District is also in trouble. Detroit Public Schools, of course, under emergency management. And Albion announced last week it wants to close its high school next year because of budget problems. Still with us are Eric Scorsone, economist at Michigan State University, and Michelle Richards, senior consultant at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. Now, Michelle, you touched on this earlier in our conversation, and I'd like you to go a little bit more into it now. Just what do you think needs to happen as far as changing the way the state funds public education?
Yeah, so that's a really complicated question, and one that I wish I had a better answer to. I think that we've really struggled as a state with determining what the minimum funding level should be for schools, and we've had some cuts to education in the past few years, and now we're looking at school districts that, like Eric said, are looking at cutting busing and are looking at limiting funding to athletics. And I'm sure there's people in line who are thinking, I'm paying to play already. I'm driving my kid to school already. At what point do we say, no, those are fundamental services that we value for a child's education, right? We know that extracurriculars matter a great deal. So do we want to make sure that our funding structure leaves enough extra at the end of the day for schools to continue to support their athletic programs and their debate programs and all the other extracurricular activities that we believe benefit kids and ultimately benefit our state? We haven't had that robust discussion since Proposal A passed in the 90s, and maybe it's time to say, what do we really need to fund and what are the extras that we're not willing to pay for anymore?
I'll put this up as a jump ball to either of you who want to answer this. Why haven't we had that discussion? Why has it been so in the back burner, and now we've got leaks starting to spring out? Buena Vista, Albion, and who knows what's next? We certainly know about Detroit and Pontiac, but why haven't we had the discussion?
Well, I think there's a bigger discussion beyond just school funding in terms of the entire state government funding itself and how we raise taxes. And we had that big debate in the 90s over Proposal A. You know, I think Governor Granholm did try to raise the issue several times about, for example, expanding the sales tax to services in several different. In fact, we did it, and then we sort of, you know, took it away after several weeks. I think we've had discussions, but nobody's really been willing to go forward and really put forward a bold plan to say we need to rethink, you know, whether we should have just a sales tax on services, and we should lower the rate of the sales tax, or we should, you know, if Congress allows us to tax the Internet, that would be a big change. So no matter how much money goes to schools, and there's certainly a huge debate over how much school funding there should be, there's sort of a bigger question even of, you know, state revenues and generally how we raise revenues in Michigan, because we have a system that is probably not very functional for the 21st century. And so, you know, I think we need to have that. People are talking about these questions, but nobody's really coming forward yet with a real plan that people can kind of analyze.
And it's interesting, there have been many editorials about consolidation, about Buena Vista, and reading the comments that are posted to those editorials, there seems to be a fairly strong feeling among some in Michigan that talk of consolidation is just another way to boost charter schools and privatization. Charter schools, they say, have made things worse for some of these districts. What do both of you say to that argument?
Charter schools have certainly led to lower enrollment in some districts, yes. They have roughly 10% of the student enrollment. I'd have to double-check that figure. But it's relatively small, the number of kids that we're talking about going to charter schools. And I think that when you start from that premise, it makes it very, very difficult to have a conversation that says, what do we need to do to provide the best education for children in our state? And if you can't have that conversation that says, you know, we have roughly $12 billion that we invest in public education, is there a better way to spend it? Is there a different way to spend it? The answer to that question may be no, but if you start by pointing the finger at charter schools, then you can't even have that discussion to make sure that we're making the right investments for our state and for children.
All right. I want to, you know, we've already had that no more high school announcement from Albion, Eric, and I'm wondering, what will you be watching for in terms of warning signs from other Michigan districts?
Well, I think the question now is, are we going to see more of this in the coming, you know, say, year? Because I think, you know, even, and this is the big question, because the economy has recovered in Michigan to some extent. We're certainly not back to where we were in, say, 2000 by any means. But we're seeing some economic improvement, and maybe the national economy is going to start improving. So that'll help a bit, you know, buoy things a bit. But there's still going to be those structural problems. And I guess the question will be over the next year or two, you know, do we start seeing some more districts talking about, you know, shutting down busing? You know, really those really tough decisions, because that's where it's going to come down to, okay, now we've got to either close schools, shut down busing, consolidate. And I expect those discussions will continue despite an economic recovery, because it won't. The recovery is likely not going to be enough to boost revenues to offset these problems. And so I think we will see that. I think a lot of districts will manage. They'll find ways to do that without sort of extreme, like we've seen in Buena Vista, but I think we will see more of this, especially with smaller districts, where, as Michelle pointed out, you know, especially with declining enrollment, that's going to be one of the critical factors.
And Michelle, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll be watching, too, for some leadership from Lansing and from our state leaders to help districts see a path out of a deficit or of a difficult financial situation. We have, you know, over 500 districts in Michigan. We can't let these financial troubles be individual circumstances. We need to share some best practices about what creative tools people are using to increase enrollment or to find more funding or to find more efficient ways to fund, whether it's giving some incentives to consider consolidation or it's sharing effective best practice. I'll be interested to see what some of the leadership does in the next year.
I've been speaking with Michelle Richard, who's a senior consultant at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing, and from Michigan University, economist Eric Scorsone. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And again, recapping the news, teachers and students in the Buena Vista School District have returned back to the classroom today. That's after school board members voted Friday to get the district's 27 teachers back on the job. The 400-student district hadn't held class since May 3rd because it ran out of money for payroll. State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan approved the district's deficit elimination plan last week, and that freed up the release of $460,000 in state aid to the district. However, School Board President Randy Jackson said Friday he didn't know whether the district would be open next year. Let's turn now to a Michigan pastime so many of us enjoy at this time of the year, and that is birding. As I sat at my kitchen island early this morning, getting cozy with my first cup of coffee, everything around me was quiet, except, happily, for our winged and feathered neighbors. All around me was a delicious little symphony of bird calls and chirps. And that leads us to pass along this tidbit. Did you know May is the height of birding season here? Our state bird is the robin, but there are literally hundreds of species who call Michigan home. Teresa Duran knows about this wide assortment of birds that we can find in our own backyards and gardens and just how important it is that we preserve land to keep these hundreds of species thriving. Teresa Duran is the publisher of Nature Conservancy magazine. Welcome to Stateside, Teresa.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, that cardinal or sparrow who's bopping around in our yards, that got me wondering, just what role does that bird play in our ecology?
Oh, absolutely. Birds are incredibly important. One of the things that I would note is that they eat insects, and they really help keep down the insect populations. And, you know, as you mentioned, right now there are hundreds of bird species literally migrating through Michigan. April and May are just the height of birding season. Some of the most amazing flyers fly all the way from South America up to the Arctic. And it's incredible to think about these tiny, tiny little winged things that, you know, fly, say, you know, across the Caribbean, and they don't stop. It's really incredible. And many of those species will sample the insects in your own backyard or garden.
Oh, well, they're welcome to do that, I'll tell you.
Exactly.
Overall, what's the state of the bird in Michigan?
It depends on the bird. One of the birds that I like to talk about is the Kirtland's warbler, which is a really iconic, important bird in Michigan, an endangered species that has been making a comeback thanks to habitat preservation. Now, some birds, like the robin that you mentioned or the cardinal, you can see those in your backyard. You can find them anywhere. But other birds, like the Kirtland's warbler, have very specific habitat needs. This bird happens to prefer jack pine forests and they breed in Michigan, found almost exclusively in Michigan, and then they fly down to the Bahamas every year. And so preservation in both of those places has really helped the bird to rebound. Another species I like to talk about is the piping plover, and it breeds only on sandy beaches on the Great Lakes, mostly actually on Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And we do censuses of the piping plovers every year, and we try to protect the places that they need to breed, especially on the beaches.
And are we doing well as far as preserving these species?
There's work to be done, but habitat conservation has made a huge difference. And organizations like the Nature Conservancy, which I'm from, have worked with the people of Michigan to preserve some of the most important habitat for these species. For example, the Nature Conservancy has preserves throughout the state. There's one called Kitty Todd Preserve, which has a really broad spectrum of different kinds of habitats. There are oak savannas and wetlands and grasslands, and you can see some amazing birds there.
I'm wondering, how are the changes in our climate impacting our bird population?
You know, climate change does impact pretty much every species, and birds are no exception. Birds migrate at slightly different times because of the changes in climate. The food that they need may not be found when they used to find it, and so we have seen shifts in migration patterns because of climate change.
And what does that mean? What's happening because of that?
It means that the birds are flying earlier. It means that they're flying later, you know, depending on the season. A lot of birds, as I said, migrate through Michigan. You guys are on the central flyway. And that means that birds that used to, you know, go through in, say, late April are now showing up in early April.
And are we seeing an impact in bird population? Are birds dying off because of changes in climate? Or are we still in a pretty steady state as far as their population?
You know, I think most important is really protecting habitat and protecting habitat that will allow the birds to make the adjustments that they need in order to survive. And where we've put resources into doing that, like for the Kirtland's warbler, we've seen really dramatic growth in populations.
I'm speaking with Teresa Durand. She's the publisher of Nature Conservancy magazine. Teresa, how do we begin as individuals to understand and really appreciate the birds living in our backyards?
You know, one of the things that I love about birding is that it's a hobby anyone can enjoy. My 3-year-old son goes birding with me. My grandmother birded until the very last. And it's easy to get started. You don't need a lot of gear, and you don't need to exert a lot of energy if you don't want to. Basics are a pair of binoculars and a guidebook. I got my first pair of binoculars for about $35 at Walmart, and I still have them. And a good guidebook, like Sibley has a good one, or Peterson, that will help you get started in understanding how to identify the birds. And then another great tip is to get hooked up with your local Audubon chapter or your nature center or your bird store and go birding with somebody who already knows what they're doing so they can show you the tips and tricks of how to listen and how to look so that you can see the birds that are all around us. Of course, you can check them out in your backyard or in your garden, and creating a bird-friendly backyard is not difficult. They need food. Sunflower seed is really popular. They need water. You can get a basic bird bath for not very much at all. They use it for both drinking and cleaning. And, you know, I was talking about my son. He loves to help fill up the bird bath. And they need a place to nest. So landscaping of different sizes, trees and shrubs, will give you a variety of bird visitors.
And you had mentioned we've got some good preserves in Michigan for bird watching.
Indeed. I would highlight Erie Marsh, which is on Lake Erie. That's an excellent place to see land birds and water birds, like you could see egrets there. You could also go to Nanweston Preserve, which is a beech and maple forest, and it has a great system of trails. And that is also actually a great place to see spring wildflowers, which are blooming right now. And then another place to check out would be the Kitty Todd Preserve, which I mentioned before. They have a population of lark sparrows, which don't nest anyplace else in the region. You could also see yellow warblers this time of year, bald eagles. Lots of great places to go birding in Michigan.
I'm curious, Teresa, what began and what has driven your own love of conservation and nature?
Well, you know, we have an article in the most recent issue of Nature Conservancy magazine called The Birding Effect. And it's about one of my colleagues and how he has become an obsessive birder and how that led him to conservation. And I think a lot of people take that path. I think of birding as a gateway drug to conservation, if you will, because once you start observing these birds and observing what they need in order to live, it starts giving you a different appreciation of the landscape and of the nature that we all need to survive.
Teresa Duran is the publisher of Nature Conservancy magazine, and you can actually find that story she referred to on birding in the new issue at magazine.nature.org. Teresa, thanks so much for talking with us on the program.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
And before we end today's show, we have a bit of news that, as the media, we found interesting. A pair of bills is up for a hearing this week in Lansing. The bills would make it easier for people to challenge government agencies that deny requests for public information. The bills are a response to blanket denials and sometimes exorbitant fees charged by state agencies and local governments for requests filed under Michigan's Freedom of Information Act. The legislation would limit most charges for FOIA requests to no more than 10 cents a page, and it would create a Michigan Open Government Commission, a group to hear challenges filed after a public agency denies a citizen's request for records.